Hello, it's Monday, September the 20th, and this is the Andrew Pearce Show coming from the Daily Mail newsroom. Coming up, who'd have thought it, one of the fallouts of the pandemic, the number of dogs that have become part of the divorce settlement. Boris Johnson, he's in New York, then going to Washington to see the president. He's talking about climate change. GPs, 80% of us would see a GP before the pandemic. The number's 57% now. In some countries, only 45%. The Daily Mail wants something to do about it. But first, the gas crisis. Soaring gas prices means, potentially, the government may have to step in to help energy companies. Wholesale gas prices are still soaring, now up 70% since last month. The government is considering offering emergency state-backed loans for some of these companies as bills continue to rise for customers. The business secretary, Kwasi Kwarteng, is holding crisis talks with industry chiefs today. I'm joined now by Dale Vince. He's a green energy industrialist and founder of Ecotricity. Dale, if you could explain to people listening, first of all, what's caused this big spike in prices?
Yeah, sure. It begins with a shortage of electricity in our country. So our nuclear generators are very old now, and they failed to come out of scheduled maintenance at the end of the summer as planned. And so that left us with a shortfall of electricity. At the same time, we've just had the least windy summer for 60 years, which means our wind fleet is also underperforming. And to top it all, there's been a fire on one of the cables or interconnectors between us and Europe, through which we do draw electricity when we need it. So three things have contributed to a shortage of electricity, and our system turns to gas, to burn gas to make electricity for the shortfall. But that itself is in short supply. There's a big demand in Asia post-pandemic. Russian supplies to Europe have been reduced for what look like political reasons, yeah. And the UK has very little storage capacity. So it's all come like a perfect storm. The price of gas has rocketed up. It's taken electricity with it. And, you know, we're at the end of the Russian gas pipeline and vulnerable to these global shocks in supply and demand.
Why have we got such poor storage facilities? I gather we got rid of a lot of the capacity some years ago. Why did they do that? The government.
I don't know if it's for economic or political reasons. I really don't understand it myself. But we've got 1% of Europe's storage capacity and we've got 10% of Europe's population. So that doesn't really square.
No. And you've identified the problem with wind power. We have, don't we, the biggest offshore wind farm in Europe, if not the world, just off of Yorkshire. But wind capacity has been sharply down. Do we need to develop more alternatives? Do we need to develop more nuclear energy, Dale? Or do we have to utilise the ocean, which is all around the British Isles?
Well, the nuclear fleet is underperforming as well. It's not the kind of magic answer that people often say that it is. We do know that wind is dependent on the weather and that it comes and goes. This is a 1-in-60-year event. It's just happened at the same time as the nuclear boys are down as well. And the cable to France is on fire. You know, so it's a bit of a combo. We actually need to build more renewable energy sources from the wind and the sun. We could try to harness the ocean, the tides. They are very predictable, but the energy from that is much more expensive. But ultimately, what we have is a shortage of capacity in our country. We need to build more ways to make electricity.
And do you sense that the government was prepared for this? Because there's often criticism of energy policy. Is there joined up thinking in government about energy policy? And people tell me there's been no joined up thinking about energy policy in government for 40 years.
I think that's fair. Actually, there is no joined-up thinking. You know, the energy market has been like the Wild West for the last, let's say, 4 or 5 years. We've seen about 70 new entrants enter the market. They've come in unprepared, underfinanced, and they've run reckless business models. They've not been hedging the electricity and gas needs forward. They've just been taking a gamble that the market price will continue to fall. And they've won that gamble for the last 3 years, and they're losing it big time now. It's just not been done properly.
And do you think the solution from the government is to step in to give loans to some of these energy companies? Also, some energy companies are saying the green levy or the green tariff in our energy bill should be stripped out so that consumers are spared the full brunt of the rising gas costs.
Yeah, I'll take the second point first. 25% of everybody's electricity bill is a government tax of some form or another for renewables obligation, the CFD, the feed-in tariff, warm home scheme, all kinds of stuff that's been lumped onto electricity bills. While the government wrings its hands and says it's worried about high energy costs, it's a big part of the problem itself. It definitely should take those out and put them into central funding. You know, in the same way that... for example, if you go to a supermarket, the $3 billion we spend a year supporting farmers doesn't find its way onto your bill at the checkout, you know. We fund it centrally. But it is a regressive way to do it, and it is keeping energy prices higher than they need to be. Will the government lend money to struggling suppliers? I think not. I think it will let the strugglers go out of business, and it will lend money to the companies that take over those customers. So probably some of the bigger energy companies in our country right now will be asked by Ofgem and the government to take the 500,000 customers that were abandoned last week by their suppliers going bankrupt and the 1 million that are expected in the next week and ask them to take them on. And what they're asking them to do is take on loss-making customers at a time when market prices are crazy and they can't hedge the power, so they're guaranteed to lose hundreds of millions of pounds. And I think, yeah, the government will offer to lend money for that, but I don't think that's enough. I think the government should fund it. I don't see how it makes sense to lend somebody losses to do you a favour.
And just finally, the long-term problem here will be a lot of the smaller companies that have been set up to try and create more competition in the market, they've gone, they probably won't come back, and it'll be the same old big companies like British Gas mopping up in the end.
Yeah, but these old companies weren't doing a bad job, and right, the notion of competition is actually a false one. If you look at the, you know, 60 or 70 new entrants, they all did the same thing. They sold energy for less than it cost them to buy it. They all ran loss-making models. The idea was to grow quickly a big customer base with these silly prices and then sell themselves. Nobody's managed to do that. And so it's a kind of false idea that competition is the answer to the problem. Our fundamental problem is we don't make enough electricity and gas here in Britain anymore. We depend on foreign markets, and no amount of retail competition can mask that.
All right. That's Dale Vince, the green energy industrialist, who's the founder of Ecotricity. Thanks for joining us. Visit mailplus.co.uk/subscribe to get access to all our podcasts, our videos, opinion pieces, and much more. Do get in touch. Tweet us at MailPlus or me at Tory Boy Pierce. So the Daily Mail has launched a campaign today to raise the number of in-person doctor's appointments. It's amid growing fears serious diseases such as cancer are being overlooked. Before the pandemic, around 80% of GP appointments were face-to-face, but the figure was just 57% in July, despite life returning to normal, and in some parts of the country, as low as 45%. Dennis Reed is director of Silver Voices, a campaign group for the over 60s, and joins me now. Dennis, it must be so frustrating because I imagine most of the people who you represent have been double jabbed, so they are not as frightened of going into a doctor's surgery as they might have been when this terrible pandemic first gripped the country, and yet they are finding it almost impossible to get to see a doctor face to face.
Yes, that's quite right, Andrew. There's, for the last 6 months or so, there's been frustration expressed to me from many of our members that they and their families are having real difficulty in accessing a doctor, or indeed any professional at local level. And all the time they are put off by receptionists. They're told that they can only have a telephone appointment. Sometimes it's not even a telephone appointment with the doctor, it's a telephone appointment with a practice nurse or a pharmacist, and the whole thing is sort of seems to be lined up to dissuade older people from accessing their local primary health service, and it sort of feeds into the feeling that during the pandemic older people were treated as second-class citizens, and it's continued since the pandemic. So an excuse has been made of the pandemic to basically change the way in which primary health is being delivered. And yes, we're campaigning strongly against that. We had a petition on the government website to create a legal right for patients to have a face-to-face appointment with their doctor.
So, Dennis, I hope you don't think I'm being patronising of older people, but I would have imagined that they would some of them won't have a smartphone and others might struggle to talk to a doctor on a Zoom call if they've indeed got the technology for that, or Skype. And they're the very people who should be able to, by right, I would say, unless it's a minor ailment they're complaining about, see a doctor face to face.
Yes, exactly. For many over 80s, they don't have a smartphone at all, and they'd struggle to understand what a Zoom call actually was. And I think there's always also the feeling that older people are not comfortable necessarily with remote consultations. They don't like describing their symptoms over the phone. They certainly wouldn't like to be videoed describing their symptoms. And of course, a lot of complaints and ailments cannot be diagnosed through remote consultation. You know, you need to be there in the room to talk to somebody and who knows about your overall health and can actually draw conclusions from perhaps a rather disjointed conversation about symptoms.
And the Mail on its front page today has two harrowing cases. Lisa King lost her husband, Peter, who couldn't see a GP. Another woman, Marina, with her mother, Ellie, fobbed off, she says, was her mother. They both died. There is evidence, is there not, Dennis, that medical issues are being missed by doctors who don't see patients face to face?
Yes, I've had many examples sent through to me as well of people who've tried to describe a worrying mole that is bleeding on their backs and need to see a doctor. They're told to send in a JPEG photograph. Many 80 or 90-year-olds know what a JPEG photograph is? It's on their back, so it'd be quite difficult if they live alone to actually send such a photograph in. And this is happening throughout the local health service. Physiotherapists are now often by default having a telephone conversation. So what they're doing is they're sort of describing a few exercises over the phone and then sending an internet link so that people can see a video of somebody prancing around and doing the exercises. I mean, this is really not good enough, and we do need to challenge it. And I'm really pleased about the Daily Mail campaign.
And just finally, Dennis, what more can be done? What are you doing with Silver Voices to lobby the government to try to lay the law down to these GPs, who, after all, they get paid good salaries, 100,000 a year? What are you doing, and what do you suggest others do?
Yes, well, this is a cross-party campaign. We're not sort of trying to make political points in this. So we're asking our members to lobby their local MPs, and a lot of them are writing into their local MPs about this. We've also got this petition on the official government website, which asks for the creation of a legal right to face-to-face appointments, because the problem at the moment is that there is guidance from the government which says that patient preference should be respected, but it's being ignored. So either the guidance has to be given a statutory basis, or there should be the creation of a legal right to ensure that people can see their doctors and other appropriate professionals.
Very interesting. That's Dennis Reid, who's director of Silver Voices, a campaign group for the over 60s. And do keep reading the Mail, because this is a campaign that's ongoing, and we're going to keep pushing till we get something out of the government. Visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to The Andrew Pearce Show for free and in full, along with our other podcasts and our video series. Remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. Boris Johnson, who's in America, is holding talks in New York before the White House summit with Joe Biden. He's talking to the United Nations. His top priority is to create a $100 billion fund to help developing countries to go green. He wants agreement on that struck at the big COP26 conference in Glasgow later this year. He's hoping to persuade countries, including the US, to get on board. I'm joined now by environmental campaigner Jeff Gazzard. Jeff, as he left Britain, as he got on that plane, he said he thought it was barely a 6 in 10 chance that there'll be a deal struck by the conclusion of the COP26 summit. That's not very optimistic. It could, of course, be expectation management, which politicians are very deft at, prepare us for the worst, and when something half good turns up, we think it's great.
I like that intro. I think the only way I can counter that is to say any expectation management I have on a personal level of Boris Johnson's statements ever coming to fruition is lower than 60%. There's a big difficulty here. You're quite right to point out that the politics of climate change is about negotiation and give and take. The difficulty we have, and our Prime Minister has, is that in recent weeks we've cut our overseas development budget. So that's a little bit tricky for him to say, on the one hand, we've cut our overseas development budget, and then ask the rest of the world to cough up for climate change, which is vital and necessary. So I'm going to stop being churlish. Let's wish him the very best of luck. I hope this isn't expectation management, other than in a good sense, and that he and Biden can actually squeeze this figure, which sounds a lot in practice, but is actually divided up by the poorer nations of this world pretty low in terms of the mitigation costs that they're going to incur if we don't get climate change under control.
And what would happen to that money? Who would control the spending of that money amongst some of the developing countries? Do we just give a blank check to the president or prime minister, or will the money be channeled through the United Nations or another agency?
Well, it's channeled through the UN. It's a UN fund.
Yeah.
You can have a degree of sophistication where you put people from the World Bank and other institutions on a board that manages it, and that's the kind of strong statement in terms of ethics that I would want to see. Much of this is channeled down through proper, legitimate NGOs, and they do work with the government departments and agencies in other countries, there's no question about it. They also work with NGOs in those nations too. But the point you're making about audit and is this money really going to have an impact,
yeah,
in the right sense, and how do we monitor that, I think is very valid. But I'm pretty convinced myself that the kind of audit functions and oversight that the UN can provide are pretty good on these issues.
And he's going to say in his talks, he's meeting the Brazilian president today, he's meeting the leader of South Korea and others, he's going to push for concrete action on coal, cars, trees. So he wants to see why a big, big tree planting program in some of these countries.
Tree planting is a bit of an issue for environmentalists, let's be frank. The issue of car standards is welcome. The issue of any standards across any field of technological development is one way that we will meet our climate change targets. Let's get back to trees. You have to plant 3 trees for everyone you hope to survive to maturity. You have to make sure that your programs in terms of tree planting are not just offsets. They're not a replacement for a mythical CO2 saving somewhere else. And you have to make sure that the numbers overall are going to fulfill a realistic climate change target. The problem is that unless you have action across all those fronts and you rely on tree planting, not only is that an offset, to make the worst pun I've ever made, it's also a COP26 cop-out. And that's the issue. Offsetting, which essentially is what we're talking about, has a role to play, but it's right at the very end of the timetable when you've done all of the technology, all of the mitigation, all of the behavioral change, and everything you can do to stop those emissions, the CO2 being emitted in the first place.
If I could ask you just finally, Jeff, is it all not in vain if, as we understand, the Chinese snub the COP26 conference in Glasgow? They are the world's biggest emitter of greenhouse gases. They're still opening coal mines at a rate of knots. They seem indifferent to international public opinion. If we can't get them doing something, we're such a small contributor. If China's not there, is it all in vain?
Well, it's a very fair point. The Chinese, you know, even the People's Republic of China has a burgeoning middle class and, dare I say, the bourgeoisie. If you look at the growth rates of air travel, China is coming back pretty quick on that. If you look at their investments in high-speed rail, not only is that good for the environment, but it's an indication of how their middle classes are burgeoning. People want to travel around internally, you know, quickly and efficiently, safely and environmentally friendly way. The point I'm making here is that pollution in Chinese cities is high. They're under pressure from their own population to reduce the impact of the motor car. Some of the best electric vehicles in the world now are coming out of China in a literal and physical sense to be exported everywhere to help us, you know, save our problems on emissions. So the issue of China is, let's look at political posturing for political posturing's sake. What you've said about Boris Johnson in your intro can just as easily apply to President Xi. So there's a lot of effort in China. About a year or so ago, they started their first internal emissions campaign. There are political engagement between NGOs and UN bodies all the time on this. So once again, we're going to finish, I hope, where we started with, try and get behind the political posturing. I hope COP26 does mean that China can sign up to these targets, but irrespective of that, they will be under pressure internally and internationally to meet these goals, come what may.
Very interesting. That's the environmental campaigner, Jeff Gazzard. Thanks so much for joining us. Deputy Sports Editor Matt Gatwood's here with the latest. And farewell, Jimmy Greaves. Sadly, not farewell, Sir Jimmy Greaves, despite the best efforts of this newspaper, actually, Matt.
Indeed, indeed. Yeah, we were trying to get him a knighthood for a long time, and it fell on deaf ears, sadly. So, but, you know, regardless of that, he will be remembered as the ultimate goal scorer. I mean, that's what everyone who has been paying their tributes over the last 24 hours have been saying, that this guy, I mean, I don't remember him as a footballer. I actually remember him, and it's interesting because people, depending on what generation you're in, you either remember him as this brilliant footballer, or you remember him as this brilliant TV personality.
With Ian St. John.
With Ian St. John, which for me was a must-watch on a Saturday morning, watching his show, which was just such good fun. It was always light-hearted and really, you know, didn't take itself too seriously. But going back to the football, I mean, his statistics just tell you that he was this absolute wonderful finisher, wonderful goal scorer. And of course, this was in an era where the pitches were awful. You know, they were muddy, they were bobbly, they were bouncy, and it was hard to do what he did. It was all right, it was quite easy to kick people, but it wasn't so easy to control the ball and finish. And that's what he did remarkably. I mean, his statistics, as I say, just bear that out. For example, just looking at England, 57 appearances and 44 goals.
That's incredible, isn't it?
Well, it's a higher strike rate than anyone else for England. Yeah. So Rooney scored, you know, more goals than him, but over, you know, far more games. It took Rooney 100 games to get to the same goal mark as it took Greaves in 57. So that just shows you, you know, scoring almost three goals in four games. So, yeah, a wonderful footballer, but also anyone who knows him and who'd met him and spent time with him will tell you what a wonderful bloke. Humble, really lovely guy. Didn't take himself or the game too seriously, and just always sort of said, well, you know, playing football was what I did. I didn't try hard at it. Didn't really want to do it, but I was just good at it.
And he battled back from alcoholism.
He did. Yeah, so when he retired, when he stopped playing, where his career, he had a wonderful career with Tottenham, where he was really at his peak, and they were a very, very good side. We started his career with Chelsea, who weren't a particularly good side. They were battling relegation. Then he went to Milan for one season, basically because they were offering him more money to play because the minimum wage was in England. Then he came back to Tottenham, had his sort of heyday. Then they kind of got rid of him, really. They didn't want him anymore. And he went to West Ham, and West Ham, again, were not the force they'd been, so they were struggling. So they was at four clubs. He only really had his sort of most successful, almost enjoyable time for him was at Tottenham. But then when he stopped playing, he then kind of didn't know what to do with himself, and that's when he had troubles with alcohol. But fought back from that, and obviously, as we know, then went on to have his hugely successful TV career.
Yeah, and fantastic coverage. And the Mail actually did a big spread on him today. I thought Jeff Powell's piece today was really wonderful. And Jeff Powell, of course, veteran sports writer, he actually knew him.
Yeah. Lovely piece. And obviously spent a fair amount of time with him, you know, in various pubs when he was a player.
Yeah.
Knew him well. And there's another piece in our page as well by Martin Samuel, who used to ghostwrite his column as well.
Oh, did he?
And said, you know, within that piece, what a joy he was to work with, and how he made a ghostwriter's job so easy because he gave all these tremendously witty and funny responses, which meant you didn't need to sort of, you know, put any gloss on his words because they were already pretty good. So there are a lot of lovely pieces written about clearly a very lovely man.
And on the current football, Manchester United, they sneaked it the last minute.
Oh, absolute brilliant drama yesterday in Manchester United's game. So they are now joint top of the league, having won 2-1 against West Ham at West Ham, but that only tells half the story. It was 1-1 going into almost the last minute. Jesse Lingard came on for Manchester United. Now, he was on loan at West Ham last season, scored an absolute beauty into the top corner against the club he was on loan with last season. So obviously tried to keep his celebrations quite down key because the previous fans weren't too impressed. Great finish, 2-1. You thought, that's it. Then Ronaldo had a great claim for a penalty. Somehow the referee turned it down, said it wasn't a penalty. He went to everyone who was watching it, thought, well, that is an absolute penalty. So he didn't give it, even though VAR had a look at it as well, said no penalty. Went up the other end, 93rd minute, penalty to West Ham, handball by Luke Shaw. penalty to West Ham so they could get an equaliser in the very last minute. They don't know who's going to take the penalty, so they call for Mark Noble, their veteran captain who's on the bench, bring him on just to take the penalty, so his first kick of the game.
Oh, no. Did he not remember what happened in the England final exactly. against...
Italy, when we lost the final, when we tried that trick.
Oh, so what did he miss?
So Mark Noble comes on. He's got a very good record with penalties, to be fair to him, and he takes his penalty against David De Gea, the Manchester United keeper, who let in his last 40 penalties.
Oh, no.
And, of course, he saved it. And,
wow, that's a great story.
And Man U held on for the for a 2-1 win.
And the fans must be pretty fed up with the West Ham manager.
Yeah, I think... Yeah, it depends how you look at it. You could either look at it and say, well, he has got a great record with penalties, or you could look at it and say, but he hasn't kicked a ball for the last 90 minutes, been sat on his bum, and so maybe he's not the right person to take it.
Even I, when those young men were brought onto the pitch to take the penalties in the final year, I thought, this is crazy.
Yeah,
it's like making a cup of tea and put the kettle on.
Exactly.
And warmed up.
Yeah, no, and I think David Moyes, the West Ham manager, given his time again, may think that wasn't the smartest move.
Did he manage England once, David Moyes?
Nope. He was Man U manager.
Oh, Manchester United.
He took over from Fergie. Yeah.
Not very successful.
Yeah, he was the one that Fergie sort of selected as his successor, and yes, it wasn't
always
very successful.
Always hard to follow in a giant's footsteps.
Exactly.
Just think John Major and Mrs. Thatcher. And finally, Chelsea show the mark of champions. They won again.
So in this game, Chelsea against Tottenham yesterday, which bizarrely and coincidentally, London derby, also the two clubs that Jimmy Greaves played for.
Yeah.
So
where was the match?
So that was at Tottenham Stadium. Right. But Chelsea, I mean, they battered them fairly even first half. Second half won 3-0, and Chelsea just have all the hallmarks of being champions if you look at the way they're playing, the strength in depth, the ability of their manager to make tactical change, which he did at half time, and then they came out in the second half like a different team. But they've got this wonderful combination of experience, young raw talent, goals in the team with Lukaku up front, great experience at the back with Rudiger and Thiago Silva, who was brilliant. You know, there's their joint top with Liverpool and Man U, and Man City aren't far behind them, but for my money, I just can't see anyone stopping them.
And they're the European champions, and the manager's name, he's fairly new. What's his name?
Yeah, Thomas Tuchel, who took over.
Is he a German?
Yeah, and he took over from your mate Frank Lampard halfway through last season.
What's happened to Frank Lampard? Is he just in semi-retirement?
Yeah, kicking his heels, maybe on the sun lounge or somewhere.
Well, I know they've had a baby recently, haven't they?
Oh, well, there you go. He's changing nappies, I've no doubt.
Yeah, I'm sure he's doing that. That's Matt Gatwood, who is, of course, the Deputy Sports Editor at the Daily Mail. Thanks for joining us. The writer Katie Glass ended a 6-year relationship during lockdown and ended up wrangling over a dog divorce. Seriously, Katie and her ex are negotiating custody of their canine, Stringer Bell, with a dog divorce lawyer costing, wait for it, £1,500. Katie Glass joins me now. Oh, my God, you must love that dog.
Do you know, this is one of those pieces you write, and I think it divides people, because some people and some of my friends say, this is ludicrous, it's just a dog. And then other people who know what it's like to have a dog you're madly in love with say, how can you be going through this? This is a nightmare. It's, you know, your dog, your little fur baby. So I do feel ridiculous admitting this is going on, but it's true, and it's been really heartbreaking, losing the dog.
Yeah, and how long have you had Stringer Bell?
So we got our Stringer Bell together. So she's 6 now. We were together. Well, no, she's 5 now. Sorry. We got the dog together, Stringer Bell. She's 5 now. And we were together 6 years. So we've had her that whole time from when she was a puppy.
And what is the agreement going to be? That you share custody of her, or are you determined you're having her?
He, sadly, is determined he's having her.
Oh.
And legally, the law is on his side because he paid for her.
Right.
He paid. And so in the eyes of the law, she's like a TV set.
Yeah.
He bought the dog. It's his dog. So that sort of is the end of it, except that I adore this dog. And we used to spend all our days together, and I can't bear to be without her. So we're now attempting to negotiate custody with different sort of ideas, 2 months on, 2 months off, or with him for summer, with me for winter. I mean, we're trying all sorts of things. But I'm in Somerset and he's in the Peak District, so it's a 6-hour round trip.
Yeah.
So quite a difficult thing to sort of, you know, as well as the breakup, to try and negotiate that.
And did you go to a special lawyer to handle it? I mean, I know you spoke to, according to your copy, you spoke to Randall Buckley from Richard Nelson. So is this somebody who's experienced in tug of loves, if we can use that awful cliche, Katie, with animals?
He is, yeah. So he deals his firm, deals dog divorces. And by the way, you mentioned the amount, £1,500 is the starting amount. I mean, he said these cases can go up to thousands, you know, $5,000. But it depends how complicated it gets, really.
Yeah.
And in fact, so I was in such a terrible state about losing Stringer Bell that a friend suggested I speak to a dog divorce lawyer. And that's how I found out that sadly he owns the dog in the eyes of law, that we should have got what they call a pet nut to make a plan in advance, what we do about custody for Stringer Bell, which we didn't do.
I didn't know you could do pet nups. How fascinating is that?
Or dog divorce laws. There's a whole world of madness that I didn't know existed. Dog couriers, I've discovered, because she can't just hop on the train and come and meet me. So people charge hundreds to deliver dogs across the country. And I'm sure some of that must be couples who aren't talking.
Yeah, I'm sure. And when the legal wrangling is ongoing, does it actually do you actually end up literally physically in court, Katie, or is it all done by letter between the lawyers?
So I had read about these cases where they put a dog in the courtroom and you have to wash your hands so you haven't got any dog food on it, and they see who the dog goes to. But when I talked to Randall, he said, no, not in the UK. That is in America they're doing stuff like that. In England, it's quite straightforward. Whoever paid the dog owns the dog. And if you're married, which would have been a slightly better situation, then she would have sort of been divided up along with the rest of our stuff. I mean, for me, sadly, it is fairly clear cut that he would own the dog if we went to court, and that even though I could spend thousands arguing it. So really, I'm just left trying to sort of negotiate with him, probably not making it better by writing pieces about it, but there you go.
And she's a black labradoodle. Is that her? Is that her now?
That's her.
She wants to get involved in the interview. Quite right, too.
Yeah, she's saying, let me stay. I love it here.
Yeah, and of course, is it right that you named her Stringer Bell after The Wire? Because that's one of the characters in The Wire.
Right, yeah.
So it's Idris Elba's character, really... isn't it?
It's Idris. Exactly, it is, yeah. I wanted something cute, like sort of Tinkerbelly.
Yeah.
And he wanted something gangster sounding. And then we were watching The Wire, and we were like, the crack dealer in The Wire, Stringer Bell, perfect. So if people don't know The Wire, they think it's adorable. And if they do, they think it's ridiculous.
Do you think Stringer Bell has detected that that there's tension between you and the ex? Is she upset?
100%. Oh, I think I'm always very sympathetic about the dog. So I think she's devastated. But of course, if I pop to the shops for 5 minutes, she's devastated. So it's quite hard to tell.
Because she thinks you're not coming back.
She always thinks you're not coming back. And I think for dogs, probably 5 months or 5 minutes is the same. So it's hard to tell how stressed she is about it, but she's very pleased to see me. And I mean, the truth is, she is very loved in both places. Do you know what I mean? So I at least I know she's sort of happy, but selfishly I do miss her terribly.
And you do know,
a strange thing to be dealing
with. You know, the moral for this, if you get into another relationship, Katie, and you get another dog or a cat, you've got to get the pet nut.
It's so fascinating, isn't it? I'm sure a lot of people will find themselves in this position, because you fall in love with someone, you think, you know, you're not ready to have kids, what's the next step in our relationship, we'll get this dog, and of course you're not thinking, what's the law on this, what happens if we break up, and so I think a lot of people are going to find themselves in this sort of position in the future, which is why it was interesting to write about it. I've had so many messages today already from people saying they're in the same position.
Oh yeah, I think a lot of people are sympathetic.
Do you have a pet?
No, I've got two cats, but I absolutely know if my partner and I split up, he'd say, keep the moggies. He wouldn't miss them at all.
He doesn't like them.
Well, he does, but he doesn't like them enough to want to take them away. He knows I'd be devastated.
Yeah, it's almost a funny situation because we're both so in love with the dog. I mean, like I say, at least I know she's loved in both places. But
yes.
It's because we both want her with us so much. And I suppose I feel now he's gone back to work in an office, and me being a sport writer, I'm just, you know, we're sitting in the park together at the moment, that she would have a happier life with me. But I don't think judges care about that sort of thing. No. Apparently they don't.
The law is the law, apparently. Katie, look, it's fascinating and heartbreaking in equal measures. So enjoy Stringer Bell while you've got her, until she has to go back to her dad, and then she comes back to you again.
All right. Thank you. Lovely to talk to you.
Lovely to talk to you. And give Stringer Bell a big snog and hug from me, will you?
I will do.
All right. See you then, Katie. That's Katie Glass. Thanks for joining us. That's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, download the Mail Plus app. Every weekday at 5 p.m. you can listen all over again. This is the Andrew Pearce Show. I'll be back tomorrow. Have yourselves a great evening and good night.